Hello. If we haven't met, my name's Tom. I'm a student minister here at St. James. Before I start tonight, I want to say on behalf of all the student ministers here, Jono is one, there's also Sam who's around sometimes. We really love your feedback. Our job as student ministers, we study during the week and we do stuff here on Sundays. Our job is to encourage you as Christians. Your job is to train us as ministers. So anytime you want to give us some feedback, we'd love it. If you're feeling really creative, you can give us some positive feedback. Otherwise, all feedback's welcome. Tonight, we're going to talk about temptation. Unfortunately, when we become Christians, we are not immediately made perfectly sinless, are we? If you become a Christian, you're immediately declared righteous. You're immediately built into God's family. You're immediately forgiven. But it's not till Jesus comes back that we are completely transformed. It's not until Jesus comes back that the lure of sin goes away altogether. As we go through life as Christians, we face temptations. And you've probably noticed, sometimes we face temptations and we resist. Other times we face temptations and we give in. What's the difference between those scenarios? What makes it go this way or go that way? Well, I reckon that in the middle of the passage we read tonight, we see a near perfect temptation. Joseph was a young bloke, probably about 18 years old. He had a full complement of hormones. He was far away from home. He was a long way from the family network that tends to stop people going off the rails. Although in any case, his family was a pretty messed up one. You can read the previous chapter if you want some sordid details of that. Joseph was a victim. He was a victim of domestic abuse by his brothers. He was a victim of international human trafficking, sold into slavery in Egypt. He's owned by a powerful Egyptian man named Potiphar. He would have been lonely. He would have been off balance. He would have been vulnerable. And so I reckon it was near perfect conditions for Potiphar's wife, who had noticed that Joseph was one of the best looking characters in the whole Bible. He was vulnerable, she was powerful and apparently dissatisfied with an absent husband. So in verse 7, she makes her advance. In our English translation that we just read, it's got five words, but in Hebrew it's even more terse and abrupt. It's basically like she says, sex, now. She knows where she stands, right? She knows what she wants. She knows where he stands. So she doesn't bother trying to win him over. She knows what she wants and she just places the order. It's near perfect conditions for her, isn't it? But she doesn't get what she wants. Joseph resists this temptation. Why? He's a long way from home. He could use some human intimacy. She's the boss's wife. You don't want to get on the wrong side of the boss's wife. The boss is always away. He's never going to know. He might not even care. And while the story doesn't tell us whether Mrs. Potiphar is young or old, ugly or beautiful, she's married to a rich and powerful man, and you know how that tends to go. In response to her two-word demand, Joseph gives a lengthy response. It's there in verse 8, page 41 if you're lost. Joseph gives a lengthy response in verse 8. I want us to dig into this section and learn a bit from Joseph. Let's learn a bit from Joseph how he resists this temptation. I want to point out four weapons that I reckon Joseph uses against temptation that are useful to us. Number one, Joseph recognizes the horizontal relational context for what's going on. He points out the trust and honor that his master has given him. He says, with me in charge, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he is entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, which is fair enough because you are his wife. Joseph is saying, he's put his trust in me. I've been given honor. How can I break this trust? He's pointing out to her and also to himself the relationship that exists and which will be impacted if he commits this sin. And I reckon this is a valuable weapon for us when we face temptations, whether it's sexual temptations or something else. But sometimes we need to lift our eyes a bit to really get what relationships are affected. I remember being in youth group a few years back and hearing a talk about sex and the preacher saying, if you're messing around with your girlfriend or boyfriend, you are wronging their future spouse. And I thought, oh, come on, that's a bit abstract. Who knows who their future spouse is? I want to tell you, now that I'm a married person, I completely get what that speaker was talking about. That's weapon number one. When tempted by sin, consider frankly what human relationships are going to be affected by it. The second thing Joseph does is label the act for what it is. At the end of verse 9, he says, how could I do this wicked thing? He avoids any talking around it, doesn't he? It's not fooling around. It's not a fling. It's not a bit of fun on the side. It's not meaningless physical satisfaction. He calls sex outside marriage what it is, a wicked thing. So I want to say, let's do the same. Let's not talk about finding a free copy online of a game or a movie or a song. Let's call it what it is, stealing. Let's not talk about creative accounting when we're doing our tax. If we're tempted not to declare all our income, let's call it what it is, lying. That's weapon number two against temptation. Call a spade a spade. Third thing Joseph does is to see the vertical context of what's going on. He says, how could I do this wicked thing and sin against God? Even if Potiphar wouldn't be wronged by it, even if this woman was unattached, it would still be an offense against God. Joseph recognizes that whatever the horizontal consequences of sin, God, who made everything and therefore owns everything, is the one who is ultimately wronged. So that's a third weapon that we too can use against temptation. Sometimes we fudge it a bit and say, the other person wouldn't mind. The copyright's owned by a multinational corporation. What are they going to know? But we can be helped to resist temptation if we recognize that God's standards are fixed and every sin is fundamentally an offense against God. Now, in verse 10, we see, although Joseph makes this speech, Mrs. Potiphar doesn't take no for an answer. She keeps speaking to him day after day, but he refuses to sleep with her or even to be with her. And in verse 12, when she grabs hold of him physically, he physically runs away, even at the cost of some of his clothing. This is a fourth weapon for us to notice. Sometimes, not always, we literally need to put space between us and a temptation. For Joseph, there was a particular person he realized he needed to stay clear of. Maybe there's a person like that for you. Or maybe it's a group of people like that for you. Maybe you realize, whenever I go out with that group of people, even though I've planned to have one or two drinks, I end up getting drunk and stupid every time. Or maybe it's some situation you realize you need to avoid. I know of a bloke who works from home, and when his wife goes out, leaving him on his own, he gets her to take the modem with her. He's realized that him and the internet alone needs to be avoided. I know of a couple who, before they were married, decided that they'd always make sure there was someone else in the house when they were hanging out together. Now, I want to emphasize, none of these are rules. None of these are things to judge other people on. If everyone avoided everything that was tempting to anyone, then no one would ever be able to do anything, ever. But sometimes we need to be honest with ourselves, don't we? Sometimes we need to make a call for ourselves individually that this particular tempting situation is one I just need to get myself out of. So there are four weapons to use against temptation that I think we can learn from Joseph. But here's something interesting. The rest of the Bible, which often refers back to these stories in Genesis we've been looking at, the rest of the Bible never points back at Joseph and says, "What an inspiring example. Everyone be like him." And that makes me think maybe the point of this chapter in the overall story of the Bible is not primarily to give us an example to follow. Maybe its purpose is something else. Now, there's a recurring phrase in this chapter. I don't know if you noticed it as Lachlan read it out. The recurring phrase is not something like, "Joseph resisted temptation, Joseph resisted temptation." The phrase that occurs four times in the chapter is, "The Lord was with him." And what is more interesting is that this is a phrase that's actually come up a few times already in Joseph's family history, pretty much always connected to another idea. Let's step through it. Joseph's great-grandfather was Abraham. Abraham was famous because God made him a promise. You've probably heard that a few times by now. The Lord promised Abraham land, that he'd be a great nation, that he'd bless him, that he'd make his name great, and that all peoples on earth would be blessed through him. That's the background. In Genesis chapter 26, the Lord says to Abraham's son, Isaac, "Stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands and confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. I will give them all these lands, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed." Later in chapter 26, God speaks to Isaac again. He says, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you. I will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." A couple of chapters later, God is speaking to Isaac's son, Jacob, and he says, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you'll spread out to the west and the east and the north and the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go." Can you see what's going on here? Every time God talks about being with this family, it's in connection to the promise he made to Abraham. And so what's meant to reverberate through our minds when we read in chapter 39 that it keeps saying, "The Lord was with Joseph"? What's meant to reverberate through is that the Lord was with him because the Lord was working to keep his promises. And we can actually see little hints of that as we read through the story. At the beginning of the chapter, it looked like God's plan had gone terribly off the rails when one of the children of the promise was sold into slavery in Egypt. But the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, sounds like a blessing, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. He had a great name in the house. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. Through Joseph, the nations of the earth are being blessed. And that's all good, but in the middle of the chapter, after Joseph has done so well in resisting temptation, what happens? His life blows up completely. Now he's not just confined as a slave, now he's locked up as a criminal. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warder. So the warder put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison. Now he's got a great name in the prison. The warder paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. The big thing this chapter wants to show us is that amidst all this mess, God is still at work to keep his promises. Does that sound a bit familiar if you've been here for a while? In the last few weeks, we've been looking at the story of Joseph's father, Jacob. Bad stuff happened to Jacob, and we thought, well, he kind of deserved it. He's a pretty dodgy character. But God was still at work to keep his promises amidst all that. Tonight, we look at Joseph. bad stuff happens to him. We say, he didn't deserve that. He seems like a really virtuous guy. But amidst all this, God is still at work to keep his promises. The original readers of Genesis could look at Joseph and see that amidst this mess, God was still at work. We, from our vantage point, as the New Testament people of God, we can see it from Joseph. We can also see it from a much more significant Joseph-like character. The first Joseph was his father's favourite son. The ultimate Joseph is his father's only son. The first Joseph left his father's house in Canaan and found himself sold as a slave in Egypt. The ultimate Joseph left his father's house in heaven and found himself born as a poverty-stricken baby in a sinful world. The first Joseph was a successful worker and found favour with his master because God was with him. The ultimate Joseph was a successful preacher and found favour with the crowds. Acts chapter 10 says he went about doing good and healing all those oppressed by the devil because God was with him. The first Joseph was tempted sexually and resisted. Hebrews 4 tells us the ultimate Joseph was tempted in every way but did not sin. The first Joseph was unjustly put in prison. The ultimate Joseph was unjustly put to death. The first Joseph goes on to save God's people from famine. The ultimate Joseph saves God's people from sin and from hell. The first Joseph gave the Israelites an inspiring example to help them in the times when they faced temptation. The ultimate Joseph gives us forgiveness for the times when we give in to temptation. Eventually, Pharaoh called the first Joseph out of prison, made him deputy ruler of all Egypt. On the third day, God raised the ultimate Joseph out of the grave and made him king of the whole universe. But the big thing I want to point out from the story of the first Joseph and from Jesus, the ultimate Joseph, is this. When bad stuff happens, God is still working to keep his promises. I don't want to suggest that that is the ultimate weapon against temptation. When our lives turn upside down like Joseph's, if when that happens we think that God has forgotten about us, it's pretty easy for us to forget about honouring God. But Joseph, and ultimately Jesus, show us that when life blows up, God's plan for the world has not gone off the rails. When life blows up, God is still staying faithful to his promises. And knowing that God stays faithful to us, that's what gives us strength to stay faithful to him. So I want to say, let's use those weapons we saw Joseph using. Let's consider the horizontal relational context. Let's call a spade a spade. Let's look vertically and remember that all sin is against God. And when necessary, let's put distance between us and temptation. But let's also use the weapon that the story as a whole shows us, that amidst the twists and turns of life, God is still working. God is still worthy of our trust. God is still worthy of our obedience. Let's remember this as we await the final fulfillment of his promises on the day when he calls us home. Let's pray together. Great God, as we lived in these last days, as your people waiting for you to finish your work, waiting for you to send Jesus again and destroy all sin, we ask you to help us when we are tempted by sin. Help us to use these tools, but more so, help us to see you rightly. Help us to see your faithfulness to us and strengthen us to be faithful to you. We ask this for Jesus' sake. Amen.